The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of ExchangeWire's MadTech Podcast. I'm Anne-Marie Sheedy, CRO at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be hosting this episode. I'm also thrilled to be joined by none other than our CEO and COO, one of which is Rachel Smith. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back and being in the same country, same room.
Yes, as the rest of my team.
Hi, Lindsay.
Hi. It's very strange being in the same room as all three of us together.
Well, as any podcast guest, actually, don't you think? Like, no, when was the last time that we did a podcast in person?
Fairly recently, actually.
Oh, really? Just not with me.
No, you were in the country.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's crack on and dive into our first story of the week. This is from CNA, and it's about Singapore's retail sales and how they're up 8.4% in February. So apparently the Chinese New Year festivities fueled strong retail growth in Singapore, with the celebrations having taken place in February this year. The month saw retail sales hit an 8.4% year-on-year increase. This follows January's growth of 1.6%. Taking this into consideration, and Rachel, I'm going to come to you first because you've been out in that market for the past 3 or 4 months. So I'm keen to get your thoughts on how positive do you think this current outlook in APAC is for advertisers?
So I think such a significant boost to retail sales in Singapore is extremely positive for advertisers. There's lots of opportunity for global brands in that market. I think that also that boost in retail sales, although it's clearly off the back of CNY, Chinese New Year, I think it does have a glow and a halo effect to other regions and other countries. So firstly, anywhere that celebrates CNY, what we're talking about here as well, I think to be clear, is probably the first CNY since COVID that China borders have been fully opened. Mm. So I think that's probably why there's been such a huge boost, okay. Certainly in comparison to the 12 months prior and in comparison to the previous month. And then I think that will have impacted the region in general. So I think what you see is consumers on holiday. So yep. People that live in countries that celebrate CNY get the break. So this just isn't just China. This will also be other parts of Asia that celebrate CNY, Singapore included. Then you're also getting people shopping, but traveling and traveling abroad to other countries. So I think there's an extra halo effect for brands, which is that you've got Chinese people and Singaporeans traveling abroad to enjoy their holidays and spending money elsewhere. Now, I was in Australia during CNY in February, and it was unmissable, the increase in Asian tourists over that weekend. I was in Sydney, in fairness, and I was doing very touristy things. So that might have been why I particularly noticed it. Had I been lounging around with my family on the far south coast, I don't reckon I'd have noticed it much. Sure. But I was definitely in some big tourist hotspots, you know, the beach and places like Watson's Bay for Sydney siders, getting a ferry and everything. And there was just throngs of Asian tourists. And I know there's a lot of tourism from Asia to Australia anyway, but I was quite sure that this was an extra CNY boost. So that's money that's coming into the economy literally off the back of that holiday. And so therefore, in answer to your question, AMS, what does it do for brands? I think that this boost in general is great for global brands. And I think considering that some of it's associated with CNY, that money doesn't just go to Singapore. I think it goes elsewhere within the APAC region.
That's interesting, because I would have assumed that there would have been a particular focus maybe on food and beverage or hospitality, or supermarkets, clothing, that kind of. But I'm now kind of thinking, excuse cars and stuff, but the travel industry, etc., would have been booming.
Tourist attractions,
yeah.
And, you know, yes, anything to do with travel and tourism, both in and out of Singapore, I think is the point that I'm making.
Okay. Lindsay, can I turn to you and try and get a perspective from maybe more the UK, since you've been here and you're an avid, you know, spender?
Oh, okay.
I know, yeah.
Interesting. Thank you, Anne-Marie. Because I'm from the UK and haven't been anywhere else for God knows how long.
So what did you do over CNY?
Yeah, well, exactly.
How was it in darkest, deepest Walthamstow?
It was probably raining. I imagine it was raining.
So umbrella sales through the roof.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Going very, very well on the umbrellas because then also it's really windy, so they're not surviving. Like the amount I've seen people trying in vain to hold an umbrella.
Broken brollies.
That's upside down. It really makes me laugh.
The broken brollies of London.
Yes, exactly. It's hilarious. But anyway, I think
it's a new podcast there, I think.
Well, there was certainly a video, like a photo series for a while, Broken Brollies of London.
Well, we have Walthamstow mattresses.
Okay. Yeah. Ladies, honestly, come on.
No, honestly,
really
it's
diverting now. But
yeah, Walthamstow mattresses is a.
I'll have mattress Mick on the phone before you know us.
But anyway, in answer to your question, which I think I might have forgotten, from a UK perspective, I think that it's interesting to look at. I mean, when you see that kind of spike in retail sales, the automatic assumption is Chinese New Year, CNY. I think it's interesting to look at it from how brands capitalise on it in the APAC, in the Asia region, versus kind of what we would do in the UK for something similar. There is nothing really comparable to CNY because New Year, like the New Year that everyone celebrates around the world, like is obviously big, but Christmas is the biggest thing in the UK kind of retail calendar. But it's interesting to me, obviously, the CNY has such cultural significance, not just for China, but for the region, how brands really, really embrace that in terms of the communication, in terms of the colours. There's so much they're doing in terms of the bringing out specific products that are related to CNY, related to the Zodiac. Like, there's so much interesting stuff happening that I do think there's, you know, I think the same about Singles Day as well in terms of how brands embrace that. There is a lot that we can learn in terms of brand engagement and really trying to put your brand out there, and it's so much around it feels more around brand building than performance, and it feels like one drives the other, whereas we can often be too performance focused when trying to kind of get sales and actually look at the retail boost they've had probably from focusing more on the branding stuff and focusing more on the kind of the kitsch cutesy connection to Chinese New Year and how
and
that,
the Zodiac.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, because quite frankly, there would have been some form of CNY celebration in London, in Chinatown, as there is in every global city that's got some Chinese community. So you're quite right, Lindsay. Again, you know, the potential brand glow off the back of an event like that is perhaps undercapitalized sometimes in other parts of the world and could be maximised.
I think it is. You know, if you think about Chinese tourism in the UK, just an example, it's absolutely huge. And again, it probably would have seen a massive boost like you saw in Sydney, in London, and the most visited place by Chinese tourists in the UK, which is Bicester Village, would probably have seen a huge, huge spike in retail sales because actually a lot of the staff that are hired in the shops in Bicester are Chinese speaking purely for the Chinese tourists. Like you're more likely to find a Chinese member of staff than an English speaking member of staff because it's such a popular place for them to visit. But they will have seen a huge thing, and they're really good at capitalising on Chinese marketing and capitalising on Chinese payment systems, all that kind of stuff, to really be able to make the most of it. And I think that there is a lot we can learn. And I saw pictures of London's Chinatown over CNY. It looked like so much fun. It looked incredible. But I think that from a marketing perspective, they just do it very interestingly, and they, you know, things like how they use influencers, how they use all different media that are available. There's, you know, we have a similar kind of thing in terms of Christmas and the kind of the Christmas ad, and everyone awaits the John Lewis Christmas ad, and the John Lewis Christmas ad and the Coca-Cola Christmas ad mean the start of Christmas, and every year they're getting bloody earlier and earlier.
Don't forget about all the amazing perfume ads.
Oh, and the perfume ads, which just stalked me last year. Like, I could not escape them. But I think that they are significant to us in terms of what they represent, but maybe there's more that we could be doing to capitalize on it rather than, I feel like everyone's getting a bit bored of it now, whereas I don't think anyone's ever getting bored of the CNY advertising that brands are really embracing. And there's so many good examples of stuff, you know, like McDonald's bringing out specific Zodiac toys for the what do you call those kids'
Happy
boxes?
Meals.
Happy Meals, thank you, for the Happy Meals. All those kinds of things.
I can't believe you couldn't remember that word, since Kieran has been using that word consistently in the office over the last week.
What, it's happy?
Happy Meal.
Or a meal. Or both.
No,
together.
Happy Meal. Meal. Okay. Relating to various ad tech solutions, which are apparently the Happy Meal of digital advertising.
Amazing.
That's for another episode.
Okay. I don't know where to go from there. That's kind of... I think the next story would be, it's an opportunity to move on there, talking about, in terms of conversations that are often happening in this office and in and around Exchange Wire in general. And the second story is one of our, you know, favourites. It's from the Financial Times, and it's talking about how Google is considering charging for new premium features such as AI-powered search. Now, some say this move would mark the first time Google charges for enhancements to its, well, I think we can agree, is their flagship products, which, as most people in our industry would know, is it's been free and ad-supported since its inception. Apparently, they're looking at various options, such as integrating certain AI-powered search capabilities into its premium subscription services like Google One and Workspace, as an example. Lindsay, I'd like to come to you first on this one. I'm keen to understand how you feel the likelihood is that Google would go through with a move like this.
I have so many thoughts on this. Okay. I think they could go through with it. I really do. And the reasons are manyfold. One, ChatGPT and Bing are already doing the same thing. So ChatGPT, to access GPT-4, it's like, I think, $19.99 mm-hmm. a month. And I remember there was a phase where they restricted the amount of search queries you could do per day. And then, like said, you've reached your limit, you can upgrade for this amount of money. And then for pretty much the same amount of money, I think it's £19 a month, Bing are giving you access to, kind of a prioritised access to GPT-4 on their Copilot AI tool. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to me that it's, you go from zero to 20 quid a month. Like, it's quite a jump. There's no like entry level like there is in streaming, like an ad-funded version, which brings me to kind of how this is going to get monetized down the line. But I think that Google would... Like, it's so expensive to fund generative AI. It's so expensive. I saw a tweet recently where, like, if you buy, I think this is in the US, I don't really buy from Starbucks in the UK, so I'm not sure if it's a thing in the UK, but in the US, if you buy from Starbucks, you've got an option to donate to your nearest charity, rounding up, like we do a lot of this in the UK as well, rounding up to donate to your nearest charity. And this person was in San Francisco, and the Starbucks they were in San Francisco, the charity they were that was given as the option was OpenAI. And they were like, am I really, should I not be donating to the homeless rather than OpenAI? Wow. But like, obviously OpenAI are a...
not-for-profit.
No, exactly. Mm. A not-for-profit organisation. But kind of that's the joke about kind of how kind of strange this is becoming in terms of how AI is being funded. But it costs so much money to fund it. And Google will start to see a drop in revenue in their search. They just will, like, and they know it. They know it's coming. So if that brings them, you know, $150-200 billion a year in revenue, if that starts dropping and their expenses to fund
maintain
the tool, fund the research, how are they going to fund that? Like, I mean, they hope they have the money, but they don't. But they, like, that's they'd want to be able to use one source of revenue to kind of help fund the other, and as as OpenAI kind of isn't necessarily kind of directly revenue generating yet, it obviously affects their share prices and that kind of stuff. But in terms of direct revenue generation, as a monetary value that's coming in, they won't be seeing that kind of on their P&L anytime soon. Like, how are they going to fund it? I feel like they might well start kind of making you pay a monthly fee, probably a similar price to GPT, ChatGPT and Bing Copilot. Mm. But I think that it makes me then think about, you know, given how much money it costs and given like there's no, like I saw an interview, I think it was Axios with Margaret Vestager yesterday, where she's basically comparing the advancement of generative AI to the atom bomb, which I thought was interesting. She said, AI is ushering in a new world as swiftly and disruptively as atomic weapons did 80 years ago. And if we deal with individual existential threats first, we'll have a much better go at dealing with existential threats towards humanity. Humans have never before been confronted with technology with so much power and no defined purpose. Which I think is an interesting way of defining or not defining open AI, like generative AI, because I'd argue you could say that Facebook did the same thing. I don't know what the purpose of Facebook ever was, but it certainly ruined the world. But you could also argue, like, something I was thinking was kind of, could AI be the new Concorde? It requires so much. And it's almost like it's too advanced for its own good, and it requires so much funding. But it'll become so expensive to keep generating. The opportunity that it can drive, it can deliver global economies, is in the trillions of dollars, absolutely. But no one really knows how to capitalize and harness it yet. That it could end up, if we don't, like, if regulators, if governments, and if like tech companies don't work out how to kind of handle it and manage it effectively, it could just be this huge thing that's been invested in and no one knows what to do with it. Mm. So it'll just become like defunct, like Concorde did.
That's a really interesting comparison. I didn't think about it from that point of view. When I read this article, the first thing I thought about is this is a interesting point in history in terms of the dilemma of how to monetize generative AI platforms, it didn't occur to me that actually the money that's required to continue funding that level of technology development and research is enormous and could be likened to something equally as enormous, such as, you know, aerospace, and perhaps the only other thing could be things like, space travel, which is also hugely expensive and which, for example, the American government invested in enormously in the 40s, 50s and 60s, and then investment kind of plateaued because advancements weren't keeping pace with the amount of investment that they could afford to commit to it. So it hadn't occurred to me that there might be a tipping point where actually AI can't continue to develop much further, much faster without some enormous amount of investment that actually no private company can afford. And I guess that's what the question comes down to is there a private company out there at the moment that could afford to keep underwriting this investment? Now, from what we understand, since they're publicly listed companies, from the likes of Google and Facebook, you imagine Amazon, you imagine those are companies that could run that race for quite a long time before the cash starts to run out. Having said that, though, and of course this comes very much from the point of view of not having a clue of what Google's internal P&L looks like, I know from confidential sources of people that have been working at Google that they are in their quest to, structure the way that they're running their business from now on. They are really moving their investment very far away from anything that doesn't, quote unquote, feed the Google machine. The Google machine, until now, has been search. Actually, AI is moving things away from search. So that gets us back to the original comments that you made, Lindsay, which is understandably this is an example of them trying to protect the investment that they've made in search.
There you go, $175 billion business.
And the income that they've been able to generate from that for a long time. So the question is, where is the tipping point for either of these things? At what point do they start to panic about loss of revenue in search? And at what point do they start to go, geez, we're running out of money for AI, for future generative AI development? I don't know the answers to that, but that's a really interesting angle on the dilemma.
Yeah, it looks like they're struggling. It looks like they're trying to protect it. And it looks from an innocent outsider, where's the innovation? Are they being disrupted? And what's happening? Because what innovation have we seen from them? Apart from they buy innovation, they don't create. And I think maybe this is representative of how they are struggling and they're just, you know, battening down the hatches and trying to protect their core business because there is no innovation.
But they would hate you to think that, though. They would hate for one second that people thought, oh,
well,
no.
They'd hate for me to think full stop.
Poor Google struggling. They need our money.
Oh, I know. Well, if you ask them for money, they tell you they're bloody broke. But anyway, I suppose I'm curious to know from either of you how we kind of see this filtering down into the world of ad tech and our ecosystem. Is there anything that you can contribute to that?
Maybe. I think for me, the next stage is monetizing ad funding OpenAI. Mm-hmm. Not OpenAI, ad funding generative AI. I think that is the absolute next stage. I mean, I see that, you know, if you go on to Bing's Copilot, obviously Microsoft funding into OpenAI, you do get random ads. My friend was looking at it the other day and got some ads for some white Hugo Boss stirrup jeans, size medium. And said
that is the detail, but I'm still stuck on your tracksuits.
Stirrup jeans. Well, yeah. You mean like they were ski pants stirrups? So. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. And
he was like,
I do think it's a good tool, but I think their ad targeting leaves a little bit to be desired. But I think that's going to be there's opportunity there. Like, I mean, ChatGPT is purely text-based, whereas Copilot is not, and Copilot has the opportunity to bring multimedia into it. I think ChatGPT needs to think about something along those lines as well, in terms of brand insertion, in terms of, like, you know, links, whatever, I don't know. But that's going to have to be the next way of funding it. And that's the role, that's where ad tech surely must come in.
I mean, that's exactly what I'd thought too. Surely this is going to be monetized somewhere along the line, and that's where ad tech could make things really interesting. But is there a possibility that actually generative AI platforms with subscription models become more like a SaaS business. So this is, you know, it is the same as the subscription that you pay for your CRM, for your accounting software, for your whatever else, because it is an information tool that is so much more, I suppose it's so much richer and so much deeper than search. And then are we looking at two different products? Search felt like AI in the very early days, but then it quickly became a Yellow Pages advertising product, really. Is this an opportunity for generative AI platforms to take a completely different route down the subscription model and become another software product that you need in your life?
It's so interesting because then you're talking about the use of it from a business perspective versus from an individual perspective. Yep. As a business, if my business, Rachel, wanted to pay for me to have access to GPT-4 or whatever platform I chose, I would jump at the chance. But as an individual, I'd never pay that. And I think that then that ties, it then relates to kind of what the purpose, and again, it ties back to what is the, there's no defined purpose.
Exactly.
And what's it for? And I think that I personally use ChatGPT and Copilot. They're my two go-tos. I use them all the time. And I've mentioned this in previous podcasts. I use them for everything. Like, I don't search on Google now. For anything, I will search there first.
But how clunky is it at the moment?
Not clunky. Okay. It's for me, it's incredible. For me, it's really smooth. And I love the experience, and I get more out of it than I do by searching for Google. If I'm looking for an answer to something, I'm looking for a product, obviously I won't go to them. But if I'm looking for an answer to something, I will 100% go to them every single time in a personal capacity. From a work perspective, they certainly have helped our teams be able to save time, to kind of be able to produce things, just kind of like help inspire ideas. I do know some people who work for companies who have banned the use of it in their companies. And again, this points to the defined purpose and kind of like people are being scared of it. I was reading an article yesterday about plagiarism in like dissertations and kind of in theses at university. It's running away with itself a bit. And I think people don't know what to do with it. And that makes it a bit scary. But I think that from a subscription perspective, if you had like an individual, like Fiverr a month type of thing.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people would pay
like
that.
Like a personal layer.
Yeah. How do you put a price on that time or that time saving? You know, they're going to make it up and they probably see what they can get away with, maybe.
Lindsay, on the, you're using it for everything apart from product search. Do you, are you ever concerned about the results you get, or not concerned, but do you ever read the results and think, how can I fact check this and make sure that it's actually accurate?
Yeah, sometimes. And I do think that that's where the likes of Bing Copilot comes into its own, because it does source things. Right. It shares links. So you can then click on the link and go, that is not a reliable link. Like, what the hell is this thing?
Yeah,
and that's helpful. But often I'm not looking necessarily for facts. I'm looking for maybe just opinions.
Concepts.
Yeah. And we talked recently on the podcast about Reddit, didn't we? Reddit and Reddit's connection with Google and allowing Reddit data to build Google's generative AI machine. And the challenges of that being that Reddit is not a fact-based site. And I was thinking more about this afterwards. And I thought, well, actually, often I'm not necessarily looking for a fact. Like, if I'm looking for like a symptom, and so many people will be looking at these things as symptoms and kind of going onto Google and not finding what they want and going to ChatGPT and being like, okay, I feel reassured now. I'm not dying. If you're a massive hypochondriac like me, then it's really useful for that kind of stuff. But actually,
you're not dying.
I wouldn't mind.
Just letting you know.
You might have something wrong with you, and then it might not be like a recognized symptom, for example. I am speaking. I had a medical procedure recently, and don't worry, everyone, I'm fine. But I was worried about some after effects. And I was trying to Google it, and everything was like fact-based NHS kind of health line with different things saying this will happen, or this might happen. But I wanted the anecdotal stuff. I wanted to hear from like the odd person that had done the same thing and gone, oh, okay, good. I'm not going crazy. I'm not dying. And that was really helpful to me. And often if you can pull in kind of the anecdotal stuff as just it's just reassuring. And
it's almost
not like I'm not looking for it to kind of tell me definitively if that's true or not, but
you just want to understand the experience. It's almost like population sampling,
exactly.
Like surveying who else has experienced this. What did you do when this happened? Mumsnet. That's the other place. It's
well, there
for
you
that.
Go. Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. I think I'd like to move on to the third story, because I don't think we can, unfortunately, decide what it's going to be, when it's going to be, what the efficiencies are, whether it's, you know, a business or a personal issue as to who's going to pay. But what I'm curious to know is get thoughts around our next story, which comes from TechCrunch, and it's about how Uber Eats is launching a TikTok-like short-form video feed to boost discovery. And they say it's with the aim of helping restaurants to showcase their dishes. And now, this feed is currently only being tested in New York, San Fran, and Toronto, to my knowledge. And they're saying saying that they'll allow 1 million merchants on their platform to promote new dishes by following the footsteps of TikTok, YouTube and Snapchat. It's my understanding that this new short form video was designed to kind of help showcase these dishes from top merchants. The feed will allow merchants to attract new customers and tell a visual story of their meals, which currently isn't available on any other delivery platform, according to Uber. Rachel, I'd like to gauge your thoughts on this one in terms of, could this allow Uber to establish further dominance over the food delivery industry? And if so, you know, can you kind of share your thoughts on maybe from a regional perspective and different players in different markets, or even just a personal kind of experience on that?
Could this help Uber further dominate in the food delivery market? Possibly. Mm. I can see how video promotions, because they're not called ads at this stage, since they're not advertising, they're free, simply submitted by merchants rather, submitted by merchants rather than mm-hmm. paid for advertising. I can certainly see how that could be more enticing from a user experience. I definitely think food videos, whether it's producing the food or whether it's some kind of atmospheric scene from the restaurant or something from the chef, could really be quite enticing. And to me, it seems like advertising in every other way except for that the merchant hasn't actually paid for it. So it's great promotional material. Mm. And therefore, since it's good promotional material, and if it was high quality, which I imagine it will be on the Uber platform, as long as it was an enjoyable user experience and not just becoming another sort of thing that you've got to scroll past like a pre-roll to actually get to the restaurant you want to order food from, then I think it could really enhance the experience. Will it add something to Uber that will entice more customers to the platform? I think only if actually what it does is entice more merchants to the platform. So you can imagine how if it's a feature that's offered on Uber Eats in a market where, say, you've got Uber Eats, Deliveroo, let's take the UK for example, if it's maybe a feature that they see more traction from on Uber rather than Deliveroo, maybe they make themselves more exclusively available on Uber and don't really bother with Deliveroo. It's not really how it works though, right? Ultimately, what makes customers go to a platform is usually usability and availability. So,
or if you're me, price.
Right, and well, yeah, I was going to say, I'm price.
Yeah. Okay, yep, good point. But
I've been meticulously look at the different delivery fees on various different merchants.
Yeah, right. Okay, so you're talking about delivery fees rather than prices offered by the merchants, because I'm imagining
they interestingly enough, if you look, it's going off slightly tangent, but they would charge different prices for core food, and then there'll be, depending on which platform they're using, and then there'll be different delivery fees, and then of course there'll be if you've got Uber Plus or something.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes convoluted. But will it be down to me watching a chef making the food?
Unlikely, right?
Yeah. I'm already hungry.
Yeah, this is it. So I think it's an enhancement more than anything else. It's a nice to have for merchants. Not saying that overall it won't build a better user experience that could see more people gravitating to the platform, but yeah. I think there's got to be other things that take them there. However, that we're discounting, I suppose, influencer-style content. If there was more viral content that made its way onto the platform as a result of this, you could see more users gravitating towards it in that sense.
Yeah.
And then that leads us back to the perennial question concerning a lot of these platforms is what utility are they actually offering users?
There you go.
And if they start offering users other utility, and in fact these videos, if they're user-created videos or influencer-created videos, become more like a social interaction opportunity, which you could totally imagine some of the super utility apps in the APAC marketplace doing, because that's what they've kind of been built off the back of, is high levels of mobile engagement with a very young demographic that's got a very social element to it. You could start to see how that might make user traffic shift.
Yeah, definitely. Lindsay, anything to add there?
I think that I see when I read articles like this, I think of them, like I'm sure as we all do in this industry, in two ways. One, as a consumer of that product, and two, as somebody that works in the advertising industry. So as a consumer, I'm like, oh, this is actually awesome, because I think Uber Eats are getting, you know, I get emailed by them probably 3 times a day with various offers and whatever that I never take them up on. But I think that if there were videos on the home screen and insert, like the home screen thing is more interesting for me than the actual merchant site itself, because I've already chosen it by then. But if I just don't know what to eat, I know I want to eat, but then what to eat, that's going to be really helpful for merchants. The next thing is obviously monetizing that, I think there's a huge opportunity here for, like, from, you know, you mentioned it already, Rachel, from the social perspective, the social commerce and the kind of and turning it into a from a retail media network perspective. I think that's where I see huge opportunity. And it's, you know, first of all, getting influencers, second of all, having access to premium spot, merchants have access to premium spots, and can they pay more to kind of appear on the home screen versus not. At the moment, obviously, that's all free and it kind of always has been. But I think also there's an opportunity to have advertising in between in the feed, a bit like what you would have on TikTok or any other platform that shows vertical videos. That, and it doesn't have to be a merchant, it could be a non-endemic brand, but it's a chance for Uber. And I could see certainly in Asia, you mentioned Asia, Rachel, this is where it would work really well, like the likes of Grab doing that with vertical videos and then kind of having and monetizing it through ads would be really interesting, something that I think could work really well. And I don't know if people would find it that intrusive. Certainly, you know, the people that are used to consuming vertical video would probably just be like, this is
part of the experience.
Yeah, totally.
What if you watched 14 videos and you got a free Happy Meal?
Yeah, well, I don't even know what it's called, so I don't ask me.
Yeah. Lindsay's not the target audience there. But yeah, 14 videos. I mean, for some people that would definitely work.
But I would imagine that there's going to be companies selling that in.
Rewarded video.
For sure.
Reward pain relief, probably. I don't know, but... That begs the question to the kind of negatives attached to any companies kind of adopting this TikTok style video feeds. What do we think around that?
What it turns the user experience into. Like Lindsay said, I think for demographics, audiences, marketplaces where people are really used to watching lots of vertical video or used to, I mean, you know, quite frankly, I use Deliveroo more than I do Uber.
Ditto.
And the advertising experience I do find a bit annoying. It's constantly, there's pop-ups constantly, well, offers often. And I'm like, no, because like you say, Lindsay, I'm in the platform because I'm hungry, I'm ready to eat. I quite typically have an idea. And so I kind of just want all that stuff out of the way. The advertising that's a bit more like banners scrolling, that's less intrusive. So if it was a video, as soon as it's intrusive, that'll annoy me. But it won't. But if it was also something that was experience based, that will definitely entice me. So
yeah, and I think I maybe, and I'm not the target audience for vertical videos because I don't really use any of the platforms that use them. But I think that maybe if that became the focus, like when I entered the home screen of Uber Eats, if that became the first thing I saw, that might be more interesting to me, like versus knowing where I order, because often you enter these sites knowing where you want to go. Yep. Like, oh, I want a so-and-so.
Yep.
I'll go and get it off Uber Eats or Deliveroo. It's not so often that you would use it for discovery.
Yep.
And I guess that, and Rachel, to your point earlier, like, would it entice new customers? Maybe not, unless people are like, oh, actually, I want to be able to know what to eat and kind of like be inspired. They might be inspired by going to TikTok or Instagram instead, and actually Uber Eats getting into that play could be interesting. But I think that I often get overwhelmed on Uber Eats, probably more than Deliveroo, by, you mentioned the pop-ups, but also just that this is like, all top rated in your area.
Yeah.
The next section is, top rated in the next 5 miles. The next section is, everything over four. And you're like, what? But these are all
according
the same.
According to who? Where's the authenticity and the legitimacy behind that?
Well, there you go.
And also, too, they're the same suggestions. I feel like Deliveroo does something very similar, to be honest with you. Yeah.
So I'd probably rather just be met with a few videos. I just can scroll down and go, fine. Or if I don't want that, I can exit it and then go to where I want to go. Because otherwise, I'm just scrolling.
Yeah, and I feel like even the food recommendation sort of engine isn't as good as Spotify's music recommendation engine. They need to learn something.
Yes.
I just, like, it's rare that I think, I definitely want to eat that. Whereas Spotify, I'm often like, good shout. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
That's a great song.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to go down that wormhole of music. What about post-purchase video? For Uber Eats as an example, you order your food, you order some Chinese food, and then, great, it's on its way, and you know how long it's going to be, or roughly, and it's been accepted. Then you get a video about actually, you know, a recipe or something using a wok, and there's an opportunity to buy one afterwards. Is that not kind of more of a logical process? Distracts you from waiting because you're hungry. It's relevant because it knows what you're interested in, it knows what type of food that you bought, and therefore here is something that we think could be interesting for you. You could do it yourself. We don't want you to do it yourself because otherwise you won't be spending money with us. Well, no, I can. If you look at the bigger picture, I might buy my, I don't know, noodles from Morrison's down the road. through Uber delivery or something. You know what I mean? I'm just trying to think if it's not transactional and it's more about the customer experience or the user experience, maybe that's an opportunity.
I think it's definitely a possibility. I do think when you're in that mode, once you've purchased, you're already on your phone. What's the next thing? If you know, if the delivery is going to turn up in 15 minutes and you've not got anything else that you really need to rush and do, what's the next thing you do? Hop on Instagram, hop on something else.
Come on now, you know, Lindsay, she's fopping around the kitchen listening to Belinda Carlisle from Spotify.
Of course she bloody is. Of course she bloody is. Oh, what Spotify recommending for me? Belinda Carlisle. Oh, what a tune.
I have no idea where that came from.
I don't know either.
Your Belinda algorithm.
Belinda Carlisle when she was with, what was the band that she was with? Oh God, this is wrong age demographic here.
Don't ask me.
Yeah, but I wasn't a fan of Belinda on her own.
Okay.
Just with the band that she was with that I can't remember the name of, right, because it was back in 1985.
That's a fan. Well, on that note, I think it's a timely place to wrap up because we are running out of time, and it just leaves me to thank you both for your contribution. It's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much, Lindsay.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, Rachel.
Thanks very much, AMS.
And thank you, listeners. That's this week's MadTech Podcast.